Hello, friends, and welcome to the Caroline Gleick Show. Caroline here, I'm your host. On this podcast, we're going to be exploring a variety of topics, from adventure and activism, climate change messaging, mountaineering, skiing, relationships, and how we can use sport to change the world. Today's episode is brought to you by Fat Tire. Born on a bike, Fat Tire strives to be a role model for other businesses in their impact on the communities they serve and the planet itself. Fat Tire is a certified B Corp and gives 1% of profits to environmental causes. They were key partners for my 2019 Everest Climb for Equality. They support nonprofits including Protect Our Winners and the High Fives Foundation, and they continue to use business to make the world a better place. Learn more by following them on Instagram at Fat Tire. Alrighty, we are live and I'm so excited to chat with you today, Tommy. So for those of you who don't know, Tommy is a professional climber who's made first ascents of some of the hardest climbing routes in the US. And he's a fellow Patagonia ambassador and climate activist. So today I thought it would be really fun to sit down and chat about parenthood, activism, and climbing. So Tommy, welcome to the show.
Yeah, great to be here. Yeah, and Caroline, you've been hard driving lately. It's been cool to see all that you've been doing.
You too. It was really cool. Yeah, it's been really cool just to read some of your captions on Instagram. And then also when we went to the Senate in September to testify together, that was an incredible opportunity. And yeah, I was really grateful for that. So where are you chatting with me from today?
So I live in Estes Park, Colorado. I think you said that. I'm in my van right now because my kids are running amok. We're trying to do the homeschool thing, which makes it crazy in the house. So I'm just in my driveway in my van. Yeah.
How's your family doing right now?
We've got it pretty good, really, like considering everything. Like if we ignore the rest of the world, our scene at home is really nice. We live in a mountain town. We can socially distance easily. I can get out in the national forest and go running and stuff pretty easily. So, kind of selfishly, life is decent. The whole homeschooling thing, we gotten used to our kids going off to school, so we could, crank on work and kind of do our thing. And that changed. So we have them home all the time, which is both good and bad. Mostly good though, actually. Lots and lots of super quality family time.
How old are your kids? Fitz just turned 7, right?
Yeah, Fitz just turned 7. Ingrid turned 4, like a month before that. Ingrid's the little girl. They're like peaking in, cuteness and kind of craziness at the same time.
They're so cute. I love seeing the photos of your children on your social media and just following that part of your adventure. Did you always know you wanted to be a dad and that you wanted children?
No. Definitely. Now, I think probably that stuff for me and for a lot of people was inspired by the partner that you have.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I was like a selfish climber. I thought nothing but like, sending hard climbs for so long. And but at some point you got to grow up. So.
So what? Like, when did you know it was time to kind of go on that part of the adventure?
I still don't know.
You still don't know. Okay. Yeah. That's good advice. Cause I'm always like, I'm kind of like 50-50. Like I've always sort of seen myself as a mother, but then I'm like, we love to go on our expeditions and I think that's really interesting because some people are like, you have to know like 100% that you want them. And then, people just give you different advice. So how do you juggle now your professional goals and family life with your 2 small kids?
I mean, we multitask a lot. Like we bring our family with us on the adventures a lot of the time, which has changed the nature of the adventure somewhat. I definitely think about risk management a lot different than I used to. And the trips usually, if I do a big international trip, usually I have the time where I'm with the family. And then I have like a 2-week period where I'm just purely focused on whatever climbing objective I have during that time. And I do probably 2 big international trips a year. And then the rest of the time I kind of do my normal travel, but I really try and make a non-strict policy of never being away from them for more than 2 weeks. And the only time that I've not done that was actually on the Don Wall when I was on the face of El Cap for 19 days. That's the only time when it's been more than 2 weeks. So,
yeah, that's actually was going to be one of my questions. How old were your children when you were on the Don Wall, and was it hard for you to be away from them for all those days?
I mean, I was, let's see, Ingrid wasn't born yet. Fitz was just 1 year old, or yeah, 1.5 years old that time. And I mean, in some ways it was hard, but that climb was like, it was a moment, you know, I knew that this was something that I'd never forget. And they were down there in the meadow. I could actually see them like running around in the meadow.
Make it harder or easier?
Made it easier because they were kind of wrapped up in the excitement of it too. You know, they knew that, you know, knew that daddy had been working so hard on this for so long. So he was pretty excited.
That's so cool. I mean, that's probably like deeply embedded in their DNA now, you know?
Yeah. Who knows? Who knows? Yeah. I don't really know how it affects them.
Yeah.
I know Fitz does say he wants to climb El Cap, but he doesn't actually like the act of climbing that much.
Well, so. He's still so young. I mean, I feel like when I was that age, like I would go back and forth about whether I liked skiing, because some days it's just miserable when you're a small child.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So when you're on your, I'm really curious about your international trips. So they come with you for part of the trip. Like, do they go to base camp, or do you have a nanny, or what does that look like?
Yeah, we don't have a nanny. Generally since my kids have been born, I've picked trips that are not full expedition style. Like I've kind of stopped doing those trips for now. So we go to Europe a lot. And so we, you know, rent Airbnbs in different places and travel around in Europe. I've gone to Patagonia with them a couple times, and there's the same. It's funny because it's like an alpine climbing area, but the town of El Chalten is pretty modern and legit, and actually a lovely place to bring kids. Like the culture loves children there. So when you go on Aerolíneas, you know, on the Argentine airline, they like treat you super well. You get to town, and I remember the first year I went, Fitz was really young. He was like 8 months, and I was like worried about it, but there was somebody who only gave us a house because I had a child. Like, we got the sweetest house in El Chalten because they're like, oh, you have your family with you. We want you to have a good time. And we'd go into restaurants, and they'd take Fitz for like an hour. Like the restaurant owners would take him into the kitchen for like an hour and play with him so that we could have our meal. It's just so different there than it was here. And I was like, weirdly, I was like, man, traveling to Argentina with a child is easier than not having a child. Yeah, and they're so used to traveling now that it's kind of the same. Like when we travel, they're super engaged. They're blossoming. When we're home, they're a little bit more of a pain in the butt.
That's really cool. What other countries have been fun to travel to with the kids?
I mean, we've been all over Europe.
Yeah.
We've been to, yeah. And Europe is, you know, just really, really well set up for kids. I'm trying to think where else have we brought them. I guess just Europe and South America. Those are the only places so far. Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking like if we went on Himalayan expeditions, if we had kids, like maybe we could bring them to base camp, but it's just so hard to wrap my head around, like, first of all, just getting myself ready and then getting all the baby stuff ready too. Like that's a whole nother crux. So how do you manage all the luggage, or do you have your setup pretty light and fast and minimal?
No, it's not that light and fast. Basically all trips feel a little bit like expedition travel now. Like you have a lot of luggage, you have a lot of logistics. It's like slightly stressful. You're trying to figure out a lot of stuff, but exciting at the same time. And so I feel like my expeditions actually really prepared me for traveling as a parent.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was it like? What was it like living in the van with the kids?
That could be tight. We upgraded our van when we had a second child. We got a giant one now. Still just a van though. We didn't go full RV, which sometimes I feel like we should have just gone full RV. But I don't know. Usually van life for me isn't about the van. It's about the places that we're going. So as long as we try and go places where the weather's pretty nice so that we can spend most of our time outside. We sleep in the van, and you know, you're just constantly in beautiful places and outside. So it's like one of my favorite things to do, even though the scene in the van is somewhat disastrous. Like, you know, you see all those van life photos where like the bed's perfectly made and you've got like your steaming cup of coffee on the counter and it just is like clean. That's not our scene at all. yeah, it's hectic in our for sure.
Well, I think that people really like to see the reality too. Like, I feel like some of my better performing social media posts do show like the total chaos and not just the perfectly curated like packing shots. So I think that people appreciate that for sure. Is it hard to stay in climbing shape and to avoid the dad bod?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the time to climb is harder to find. I'm kind of just like an exercise addict in a lot of ways. So I find ways to get out and run or mountain bike. I feel like I'm generally fit, but like the specific, like climbing is hugely time intensive to be a good climber.
So time intensive.
You've got to go out for like, yeah, like 5, 6, 7 hours a day, like 5 days a week or something. And I don't have that anymore. So I think I've sort of like relied in recent years on the types of climbing that my experience kind of makes up for the fact that I'm not maybe like quite as fit.
Right. So like lifting up the kids, that doesn't like help with the forearm strength.
When Fitz was born, I was like, I'm going to lose it. I got to keep training. So I was hangboarding all the time, but I was also carrying him around and I got wicked tendonitis in my elbows. So
I've heard that's really common for a lot of new parents.
Yeah.
Common injury. So how long did that take? How did you resolve that injury?
Oh, I just went to my physical therapist and she gave me like a couple stretches and some exercises, and that sorted out pretty quickly, actually.
Nice. So somebody told me that they saw you speak at that you did a slideshow many years ago, and the audience was asking about your training, and you told people that you didn't really train, you just went and climbed. So I'm curious now, do you have like a more specific training regimen, or do you still just kind of like freestyle it?
Yeah, I wonder how long ago that was. I mean, if that was like more than 10 years ago.
I think it was.
Yeah, I just went and climbed, but I climbed like, you know, 40 hours a week or something. So I didn't chart things. I didn't bring any science to it back then. I just figured that if I was climbing and trying as hard as I could, as much as possible, that was good enough. That was kind of the mentality of the day for climbers. Now with the upcoming Olympics and stuff, everybody's getting way more scientific. I had some big climbing goals that I needed to like get better. And so about 5 years ago, I started bringing in the science. Like I said, I had the hangboard when Fitz was first born. And nowadays it is a bit more regimented. I've even contemplated getting like a coach recently.
Yeah.
So that they can really lay it out for me and help me become as efficient as I can. But I haven't done that yet. I'm like a reluctant organized person. I kind of fly by the seat of my pants so much of my life. So I am starting to button up my scene, but I'm only halfway there.
Who would be your coach if you were to hire a coach? Because it seems like you have such a specific like mindset and your goals are so specific and your skills. So like, who could coach you?
Yeah. So there's an organization called Lattice Training. It's out of the UK, but they have some people in the US that do it, where they bring you into a facility and they test all of your various strengths and weaknesses and talk through the goals that you want. And they cater, make a training plan for you, taking kind of everything into account. And so I would probably use them.
That's cool. Yeah. I did a stint. I worked with Steve House's coach, Scott Johnston, a few years ago, the guy who co-wrote Training for the New Alpinism. And it was so different to have like an actual training program. And it's, I actually was like, wait, I want to be in the mountains more. Like it's not enough time out there, like in the Alpine. Like, it was really interesting. And I did really gain a lot of strength, and especially like doing the things that I didn't really want to do, like the gym sessions.
Yeah. It was helpful in the end, you thought?
Oh yeah. It was really helpful. Like I would do these because I was training to go to Peru to climb and ski in the Cordillera Blanca. And so like my workouts, I'd have to go do like 7,000 vertical feet with like a 30 or 40 pound pack in mountain boots. And wow. It took a long time. Like, luckily it was right around the time I met Rob, and he was super keen to do those workouts with me. So he would load up his pack, and then, but it was like even just hard to plan out to find the right routes where I could get that much vert in a day with weather and everything else. Like, you have to do multiple laps up the mountains here. So, but I feel like those strength gains, like putting down that base, that foundation, has been really helpful. And like, now since I went through that, I feel like it's kind of just in my back pocket now.
You don't have to continue to do 7,000 vertical feet with a bag full of rocks and mountain boots to stay strong.
I feel like I hope I don't have to keep doing it. I feel like I did that in 2015. So 5 years later, I feel like I still have that. I can like draw upon when I need it.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
Now with climbing specific stuff, like the finger strength specifically, like if I don't train it constantly. Yeah. So that's kind of the downside. You could train for months and then get sick for 3 weeks and it's mostly gone.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's like climbing strength for like hard climbing is so specific to like this part of your arm, you know, like it's crazy. Yeah. Though I feel a little bit better about myself hearing that you also kind of fly by the seat of your pants, because as all these athletes now are like always training and always showing these crazy workouts online, I'm always like, geez, I feel like I'm the same way. Like, I'm just always figuring it out as I go along. So I feel a little bit better that you're the same way.
Yeah. I feel like I'm a hybrid, because there was a period in my life where, like, you know, Chris Sharma was like the main influence, and that guy never trains at all. He just goes out and, you know, tries hard. And so that's mostly what I've done.
Yeah. Well, there's something to be said for that, but to keep your edge in the mountains, you know?
Yeah. You gotta do what keeps the excitement high. I feel like that. Like, if training is something that you don't enjoy and it's going to make you depressed, then probably shouldn't focus on it. But some people really love training.
Yeah. Yeah. It can be really fun. I think what I really learned from my time training with Scott was that, like, if you're training to be a ski mountaineer or like a ski alpinist, you can't spend 90% of your time doing that, because you'll get hurt or you'll die, because it's dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think that was like one of the biggest take homes, is to find more of a sense of balance with my training and not always need to be out there like getting that huge adrenaline rush.
Yeah. Right.
So that I can have like a long, long career.
Yep.
Do this till I'm 100. That's my dream, really.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about your skincare routine, because your skin is so nice. So how do you keep it? Do you have any moisturizers you use, or like, do you use sunscreen? Like, how do you keep your skin so nice?
That's so funny. Nobody's ever said my skin is so nice. That's a very lovely statement. I don't know. I mean, I actually am sponsored by a skincare company, Climon.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I've mostly used it. I mean, you can kind of use it anywhere, but it's funny. Like, when I go up on big walls, I really think a lot about the skin on my fingertips. Like, I don't really think about the skin on my face. I feel like I'm destined to be a, you know, wrinkly old haggard man at some point in my life. But the fingertips, it's like, that affects performance. And so I actually do bring like a pretty big kit up on the wall with me, with all these different like lotions and, you know, files and razor blades, and spend a lot of time like staring at my fingertips, trying to figure out how to make them.
Yeah. I mean, success on those kinds of things is really about nailing the basics and taking care of those little things before they become big things, for sure.
Yeah.
Do you have any hair products that you use?
I use whatever's sitting on the edge of the tub.
And then any other tips for like staying fresh and clean on an expedition or on a big wall?
Oh, certainly not my strength. I am blessed with very, I don't sweat much. So,
oh, that's nice.
And one time, you know, I've got like that climber toe fungus thing going on. And one time I was on an expedition and I was taking this super gnarly medication called Lamisil. That's bad for you. Actually, it's like bad for your liver, but it clears up your toenails. That I had no BO that for a month without, I spent a 5 week trip and didn't even shower once. And I smelled fresh the whole way. So maybe
that's That's incredible. 5 weeks. That's got to be like, that's a long stretch without a shower. Yeah.
There's pharmaceutical solutions to not bathing.
Wow. I'll have to look into that for my next expedition.
Yeah. If you're willing to sacrifice your liver, which is probably not worth it.
Not worth it. Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about Patagonia gear because I know that we're both Patagonia athletes. So what's your favorite piece of Patagonia clothing or gear right now?
You know, since I haven't been climbing much, I've gotten into running quite a bit lately. And so I've been poaching the trail running line. The Airshed hoodie is the bomb. I love that thing. For running, it seems so light and kind of like, I mean, like the season in Estes Park where I live is, you know, it's kind of becoming spring, summerish. It's pretty warm, but we still get cold weather. So yeah, it's good for that. And I'm still a fan of some of the old school stuff. Like I still wear the R1 a ton and the Cap 4 hoodie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. There's so many.
Yeah.
Yeah, what about you? What are you into?
Well, I've actually been really stoked on the new trail running shorts. I forget what they're called, but they're like these tighter sort of like bike shorts with pockets on the sides. And they're part of that high endurance running kit that Claire and Luke worked on.
Yeah. So is the Airshed. That's part of that kit as well.
Yeah. So I've been, they killed it with that. I've been really stoked on that. And then, I mean, yeah, like the R1 and then that new Zigzag, I think it's the new Cap. Or is it the new R1 for next year that I've been testing? That piece is pretty sweet too.
I think I have one.
But we have some really cool, like new light and fast ski mountaineering gear coming out next year that I'm really stoked on. Like this, it's called the Upstride Kit, and it was sort of designed for like the Euro ski tour, but it's just like really great for fast and light kind of skimo inspired backcountry skiing.
Oh, cool. Yeah. That's exciting. I'm getting more and more, and that was going to be my spring this year. Actually, I wasn't going to Europe so I could do a bunch of ski mountaineering here in Rocky Mountain. And, I started before we went on lockdown, got some good days in, but I'm sure next year I'll be excited to do it.
How's the snowpack there? I mean, is it possible that you'll still have snow into June to ski some of that stuff?
Yeah. There was quite a bit of snow this year. You have to hike quite a ways to get to the, you know, hike off snow quite a ways before you got to the snow. So it would be the kind of missions where you're out for 8 hours and you're making turns for like 15 minutes.
Right. Yeah.
Three turns.
Everything gets all muddy because you have to like put all your trail running stuff back into your pack. And
the ground here is so like rocky. It's Rocky Mountain National Park that there's almost no mud.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice. Yeah. Well, that's cool. So, I mean, it's interesting to me because like, I feel the same way, like with skiing that I like to climb and trail run too. And so like, how do you kind of like balance all these different sports that you do, or like, where does the inspiration for skiing come from?
I mean, I've been skiing. I was on a ski team when I was like 10 years old.
Oh, so cool.
I skied a bunch. There was a ski resort here in my town when I was young. That I like my babysitter. My parents would drop me off in the morning and pick me up in the evening there every day. So I've kind of always been into it, but I got so obsessed by climbing for a lot of years that I just didn't ski. And now with a family, and then I despised resort skiing forever. But then when Fitz started, and we wanted to teach him how to ski and just be well-rounded, we started going resort skiing again a little bit. And then I realized that skiing is just a really fun family activity. And I think that kind of piqued my interest. And then, I don't know, I just had a friend who was really into it here in Estes. So I usually do pretty short missions. Like I don't do big ski expeditions that, you know, I do like 2 or 3 days a year where I'm out all day, but for the most part, I get up at like, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning and I'm back by like 11.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do that skiing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is such a wonderful lifelong sport, and it's awesome that you're introducing your kids to it at such a young age, because it's really fun with my dad now and my nieces and nephews to have like 3 generations of family out on the slopes.
Right. Does your whole family live in Utah as well? Are you with near them?
Yeah, I moved here with my parents when I was 15, and my little brother lives here, and then I have a lot of extended family here, and then my older brothers live in the Midwest where I grew up. I grew up in Minnesota. Yeah. So everyone kind of comes here for holidays, and I was teaching my 2-year-old nieces how to ski this year for the first time, which was really fun, but also like a crazy workout for my back and hamstrings, like picking up the kids. It was a lot of fun. So what's next with climbing and with your mountain goals? Do you have any big projects lined up?
I had a big El Cap climb, you know, El Capitan, I'm still addicted to Yosemite, and I had a big project I thought was going to be multi-year, but we did it last year, like just ended up being easier than I thought. So in terms of like the type of climbing goal that I've spent the last 25 years of my life pursuing, I'm like a little bit directionless at the moment. But with the whole COVID situation, I've been able to go running a lot. And so I'm starting to think about these big link ups. And those are kind of nice too, because, you know, they're not, I don't feel like I'm likely to die on them. They feel like real deal adventure. And so I've actually been conceiving with my buddy Adam Stack this link up in Rocky Mountain National Park, that links all the major climbing formations. And it's probably a little bit similar to that, like Grand Traverse in Utah, like the one that goes around Little Cottonwood.
The World.
Is that what that's called?
The Wasatch Ultimate Ridge Link Up. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So like that, but with big walls in it, like, you know, like 1,000 and 2,000 foot walls that you gotta, you know, bring a rope and climb, but like, I don't know, 30 or 40 miles and like, you know, 20,000 plus elevation gain, like trying to do something. So, the climbing isn't super hard on, it's like 5'11" and under mostly, but the, just like the moving that much on my legs is what I need to train for. So I've been kind of getting into that.
That sounds like a really cool project. I love those backyard projects too.
Yeah. And I also like it that I literally don't have to drive to do it. It's like right at home, and I've been becoming progressively more self-conscious about the amount of airplane travel that I've done. So being, you know, trying to keep it close to home more often is a good thing.
Yeah. I'd love to talk a little bit more about your climate activism and sort of like how you got into using your voice as a climber to speak up for the environment.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was like, it almost just like fell in my lap. I grew up in the mountains. My dad was a mountain guide. I've like always loved nature, but I didn't feel like I had a part in saving it by any means. But then I started getting invited by the Access Fund and the American Alpine Club to do these lobbying events in DC. And I think that's probably what sparked it for me. Like, I didn't like the events per se, but I learned, like, I don't like wearing a suit. Like, the conversations are always kind of awkward. But I did get this better grasp of how the system works, like how the cake is made and what really affects the planet and how policy is so important. So it was a combination of understanding that and then having a family and that extending my view of like this time on earth that I'm responsible for isn't just the time that I'm going to experience on earth. It's the time that my kids are going to experience on earth. I started thinking about it in terms of like kind of the future of humanity, just instead of just like my own little bubble of what I would see. And then, you know, that spurred me to start reading books and getting educated. And I think once you're educated, it's just like, you feel like you got to do something.
Why do you think climbers make good climate activists?
I mean, I think climbers are really good storytellers. Like, whether they like it or not, like, storytelling is a huge part of the climbing culture. And we have dramatic stories to tell a lot of the time. And everybody likes to hear stories. So the fact that we have these good stories just makes our voices better heard and also makes us better at telling those stories. So it's really mostly about storytelling and then having this very intimate relationship with nature. Like, climbers specifically tend to fall in love with certain climbing areas and go back year after year after year after year. So I've been going to Yosemite since I was 3 years old, basically every year, to the same places. Like, you know, we climb on the same little chunks of rock. And so, you know, if a tree dies, I notice it. And if a whole forest dies, of course I notice it. And so we really have, I think we see the change in a way that a lot of other people don't.
Yeah, you brought up such a good point about the storytelling aspect of lobbying, and it's such a powerful way to connect with people and to influence change. So what other advice do you have for folks who want to get involved as activists, but maybe don't know where to start?
I mean, I'm into the ActionWorks platform a lot. I think getting involved in your local nonprofits is great for helping, you know, your local environmental nonprofits is great for helping that nonprofit. But the real value is that it puts you in a community that's accessible to you, local, right? Of people that love to figure out ways to help the earth. And so when you're in that community, it becomes part of your daily conversation and it becomes on the top of your mind every day. So, I think that's the portal, really. Surround yourself with people that care, and that will, you know, spread exponentially.
Yeah, that is such a powerful way to connect with local nonprofits and to start learning more about all the different ways of being an activist. So what are some of your activism plans going forward with this election year coming up and everything else going on?
Yeah, well, one of the things for people that are watching this, the ActionWorks platform is just, you know, it's on Patagonia's website. You can just, that's where you go to it. You find it, just type in ActionWorks and it'll bring you there. Okay, so activism going forward. So generally the month of October is like the Super Bowl of climbing, right? Like this is when I just like push everything aside and I go climbing and that's all I do. Especially with kids, I was like, I need to hold that time more holy. But this year, because the general election is obviously so incredibly important, I was like, I'm even going to sacrifice that this year because October is kind of the key month. In my mind. So starting in September, depending, I'm not sure what form it's going to take with the, you know, quarantine life, but I'm going to dedicate my time fully to events, either in person or online, to try and influence the election. All the fact that the current administration is taking advantage of the current situation and rolling back so many environmental policies is like totally freaking me out. And so that fuels the fire even more. So for me, like moving forward right now, it's like all about elections.
Well, keep us posted and keep me posted about how I can support some of that work, because it's crucial with the election year that we really mobilize people to become climate voters. And so, yeah, I'd love to support what you're doing and brainstorm too, if there's any ways we could work together.
Yeah, likewise. I feel like you have the capacity to get so much work done, more than most people I know. And so I feel like you have your hands in so many things. So likewise, I feel like I can learn a lot from you. And we can all work together.
So when we testified together at the Senate hearing in September of 2019, I was wondering, do you ever get scared or nervous before public speaking or to speak up about some of the other ways, like on Instagram? Like, does it make you nervous at all, or are you pretty chill about it now?
I mean, the Senate hearing was something very new for me, so I got a little bit nervous. I got pretty nervous at that one, I guess.
Yeah, me too.
But I've had a handful of like really high pressure public appearances that have just upped my bar for tolerance of that kind of thing. Like, naturally, I'm not a public speaker at all. It's something I never aspired to do, but I've just ended up having the opportunity to do it quite a bit. And it's just kind of progressively made me less and less nervous about it over time. Still, sometimes I blow it though. Like, I feel like, you know, 10% of the time I show up to some event and it just like feels weird and the audience isn't reacting properly or whatever. And it kind of freaks me out. Social media is a different thing. I don't, you know, I'm so used to there being, you know, I think if you're a public figure and you're doing social media stuff, you realize that a certain percentage of the vocal minority are going to seem are going to attack you, you know? And so a lot of people, when they first experience that, it makes them not want to even expose themselves anymore. I'm just used to it at this point. I'm like, whatever, it's fine. In some ways, I kind of welcome it. You know, every once in a while, I get some tidbits of knowledge from somebody who sees the world so much different from me. It makes me understand the other side of the arguments. And if people are attacking me, I'm like, that's actually totally fine.
Yeah.
So I don't get too nervous about it. What about you? Where are you with that kind of stuff these days?
I mean, I feel like it's easier in a lot of ways to like do, I practiced a lot for public speaking over the last year. And so I feel like that part gets easier. I still get nervous for sure. Especially like in the Senate, like in front of 10 senators or whatever. That was like a different kind of environment, but I do get scared on social media sometimes just because like sometimes the intensity of like the hatred or the harassment can be, it's just hard for me to deal with sometimes, even though like I know it's going to happen. It's still like mentally, I feel like I kind of have to prepare myself for some of the backlash that's coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
It kind of freaks me out.
Like it's keeping you from speaking out, which is great. Or maybe you have so much in there that it is, I don't know.
I know, like there's a lot of things I feel like I'm still working to like really be able to write what I really want to write. Like sometimes I feel like I tone it back a little bit and I'm trying to work on like really not doing that. Like I don't want to dilute my message so that it's easier for people to hear. Like I need to be, I don't know, just to say what I really want to say, but that's really hard to do sometimes. Cause I'm like, I'm going to make a lot of people really angry.
Yeah. Like I think that sometimes I have to like certain things that go through my mind would just be counter if I talked about them publicly.
Wait, what
so
did you say? You cut
generally,
out a little
if I
bit.
Have some, certain things that go through my mind that I want to speak about would just be counterproductive. Like at some
right.
point you want to have productive conversations. So if I'm talking about something that I'm doubting, I have like my own little group of advisors, mostly my wife, Becca. She's got a very, very good head on her shoulders that I vet it with. I feel like that's a good way. Like just get a double check from your friends. I think that really helps.
Yeah. My mom is sometimes that double check for me. So I'm really grateful for her when she will like read over a caption before I like press go. But yeah, you do a really good job on your social media writing about activism. And I really admire like that you're willing to, yeah, you do a nice job like with your voice too. And like the editing process we were just describing.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. How does your training for climbing help you prepare for activism?
I don't know. I mean, there's a certain amount of discipline that you have to learn to become an athlete of any sort. And I suppose you can apply that. That's the more training side. But I think the thing that probably helps me the most is the risk management stuff. Like you, as an athlete who does potentially risky things, you're used to kind of hanging your neck out there relatively often. And I think in activism, it feels that way, especially in our current political climate. I think the idea of like finding like this focal point, like this goal that you want, that you think is the right direction and driving towards that, that can be applied to being an athlete and it can really be applied towards activism as well. And sometimes those goals are so big and lofty and, you know, seem unattainable. Being an athlete teaches you that that happens and then sometimes they come true. So you can, it builds belief in activism as well.
How do you stay motivated for your activism and for climate?
I think I try and pace it properly. Like I need to, like for climbing, I just like kind of the more the better for me. You know, I wish I could do it, you know, more than I do. For activism, it's not something that brings energy to my life, I would say, but I know it's the right thing to do. So I try and pace it out and I try and pick the things that I can focus enough energy into that I feel like are high value. Like people who follow my activism stuff, there's not tons of it out there actually. It's like I'm not blasting out things every day, but the things that I do focus on are a little bit more vetted and important. And so that means I'm not spending all day, every day obsessing about it.
Yeah, because it's easy to get kind of burnt out on that.
Yeah. Yeah, you gotta mix in the joy, you know, you gotta have a lot of joy in your life. And that's actually another reason why I think athletes make good activists, because there's a lot of joy, you know, we're like happy people. We're out there with these amazing chemicals flowing through our bodies. And so when we show up in DC specifically and we sit in an office with a senator or something, we have this vibe that's so much different than people that are in the policy all day long, every day. And we can talk about these fun stories and yeah, that's good.
Why should other athletes not be afraid to be politically active?
I mean, I think the less afraid you can be, the more time you're going to put into it. And I don't know. I mean, there's no reason. I don't even know how to answer that question, really. I've always tried to not be ruled by fear.
Yeah.
You know, socially, environmentally, you know, physically, like, you know, you need to do the things that, you know, that aren't going to kill, you know, you need to make sure that you're not going to like crash and burn too hard. But as long as you're not at that point, you should just go all in as much as you can.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's like really annoying to me when people are like, just stick to skiing, keep the politics out of it, because all of these things that we do, like there were so many people who worked really hard to be able to like protect the land that we ski on today and to create like the experiences that we have now. And so I kind of feel like it's our duty to make sure that we're continuing that, you know?
Yeah. For a long time, I thought that our spaces that we play on in North America, at least, were a privilege. Like this was our right to have these places. And now I understand more that that's just a matter of laws. You know, like people made these rules and they've served us very well, but it's really our responsibility to keep that going. You know, I think that's one thing you gain when you travel. Like I've tried to do a few climbing trips to China, and China is, you know, it was pretty closed down to climbing for a long time. It's starting to open up because they're understanding the economic benefits of it. But the fact that we go to these amazing places with all this incredible climbing, and I'd see it and I'd be drooling. I'm like, oh my God, this is so good. And they're just like, nope, you're not allowed to climb there. You know, we don't really allow that here. Made me really value what we have, here in the States.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool.
Or in a lot of,
what was that last part?
Or in a lot of the other places that we play, like Argentina or the Himalayas, you know, there's a lot of places where you're allowed to do it, but there's also places that you aren't, and it can change just based on policy.
Mm-hmm. Have you made any like failures with your activism?
Failures with my activism. Good question.
Or like mistakes that you've made that you've learned from?
Well, I mean, weirdly, one of the things that got me involved with my work with the Access Fund in the first place was a mistake that I made. When I was 16 years old, I found this really good sport climbing area in Western Colorado, on the western slope of Colorado. And I started going up there and bolting these sport routes. I knew it was on national forest land, but the hillside to get to the climbing area was super loose, and we're eroding it by hiking up there all the time. And we're like, wow, we need a trail of sorts to get up. So we brought like a shovel and a pick and a handsaw up there, and we built a trail to the crag. And while we were building this trail, like a Forest Service ranger kind of like saw what we were doing, and I got busted. Essentially got all of my climbing gear confiscated, and so I was 16 years old, and I'm like, oh, I'm in trouble from the Forest Service, from a ranger. I don't really know what to do. So I called the Access Fund, and they, you know, they kind of like sorted it out a little bit for me, and I felt indebted to them for a while. So I started donating to the Access Fund right off the bat, and then a few years later I became a board member of the Access Fund. And yeah, I guess it all started from, I guess, a mistake that I made. I wasn't You know, I just wasn't thinking enough about anything but my own selfish want to develop the sport climbing area.
That's a great story, because I feel like as the narrative around like mistakes and failure in our society is like, I don't know, it seems really sometimes hard to talk about that stuff. So I appreciate you sharing that story. And those mistakes often lead to some of our like greatest accomplishments or some great parts of our lives. And it seems like you were able to really turn the lemons into lemonade there.
Yeah. And I would say there's other activism type events where I haven't put in the like the prep work. I think I regret that. Like if I have a chance to make a difference through speaking or writing, but I just don't put in the prep work to do a good job, I inevitably regret that. Like it feels like a missed opportunity. And I'm sure that's happened on a handful of occasions for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it takes a lot of time though. Sometimes it's like hard to really put in those hours. I feel like I got asked again in February to go testify to the House Natural Resources Committee. And I feel like it probably took me like 30 to 40 hours of prep work to like write this paper and prepare my speech. And it was really hard to sacrifice. It was such a good February for powder skiing. And there were so many days that I had to like not go skiing. It was really tough. Like it can be hard to take that time sometimes. So I think just showing up too is also really important, even if you can't be like 100% prepared.
Yeah. And I think when you show up in the first place, you don't really need to be that prepared. But as you learn the scene and you get better at talking about it, then you kind of get put into these positions where you are in charge. And then that's when you really got to put in the research and the prep
work. Figure out who like co-sponsored the bill so you don't ask them to support it. I've done that before in DC.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, there's a lot of great tidbits there. I wanted to kind of end. I ask like the same kind of questions to everybody at the end, these rapid fire questions. So if it's cool, I'm going to jump into that. So what's your favorite TV show right now? Do you watch TV?
Oh man, I watch very, very little TV. My wife gets into these shows on occasion, so I end up just like popping in for like 5 minutes here and there. I don't even know. I don't watch enough TV to know.
Okay. Yep. Favorite book of the moment?
So I've been working my way through. There's a couple books that I've been working my way through, but one of them is John Krakauer put out this compilation of like, you know, old stories that were published in magazines. The name of it's called, but I've been into that one. But also the Yvonne's new book, it's called, I should have come prepared for this. Once again, the prep work. What is that new book that Yvonne put out that's also a compilation of all of his kind of like untold stories? It rehashes a bunch of the important stuff, but it's called,
I'm trying to find out, Lessons from the Edge of Business and Sport. Is that it?
Yeah, but that's the subtitle, isn't it? Isn't there
it's called Some Stories.
Some Stories. Yeah, that's what it's called.
Some Stories. Yeah.
That's the one. That one's really good.
Cool.
And then actually I got one sitting here right here next to me. Stories Behind the Image, Corey Rich.
Oh.
This is a good one. I guess that's where my life is. I've got so many things I'm working on that I can only digest books that have a lot of short stories. So I'm into the short story books right now.
Nice. Okay, favorite color?
Green.
Green. Favorite food?
Burritos. I would maybe expand that into just the Mexican genre these days.
Mm-hmm. Are you a morning person or a night owl?
It seems like I am naturally a morning person, but my wife is really a night owl. So I actually am both these days. I wake up early. I do my thing in the morning. I take a nap around 3 p.m. every day and then I stay up late. So I'm forcing myself to be both.
What's one piece of advice you'd give to your younger self?
Let's see. One piece of advice I'd give to my younger self. Be less selfish. I think I was really selfish when I was young. So try and think outside of yourself. Yep. I probably still am, but I'm trying to be less. Yeah.
Where can people follow you and support your work?
I mean, my main platform these days is that I'd like to speak out on is just Instagram because it's easy. So that's probably going to be the basis. And actually, I have a whole basically memo written right now of my plan moving forward of how to be a little more intentional with my activism and storytelling. And it's the portal is always going to be Instagram. I'm going to inform everybody about what I've got going through my head or the live events I'm doing, especially during the rest of our quarantine time. I'm going to really try and do something a week, like a post a week that points people to something else, or sometime it might just be that.
So. Cool. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Anything else you want us to leave with today?
No, I don't think so. That was great.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for spending this time with me. I really appreciate it. It was great to catch up, and I'm wishing all the best to you and your family right now. And hopefully we can collaborate on some events going forward for the election.
Awesome. Thanks, Caroline. Good to talk to you.
Thanks a ton. Have a great day.
Bye.
I am resilient. I trust the movement. I negate the chaos. Uplift the negative. I'll show up at the table again and again and again. I'll close my mouth and learn to listen.
Special thanks goes to Avery Sandak for all the time he spent editing the audio on today's episode, to Rising Appalachia for generously providing the music for the opening and closing tracks, and to my partner, Rob Lee, for being extra quiet in the house where I'm recording. If you learned something from today's episode, share it with a friend. Until next time.